Hello and welcome to this, the 100th episode of our podcast from the Business Marketing Club, or BMC. My name's Dave Stevens. I'm a B2B marketer and I'm chair and co-founder of the BMC. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community network of B2B marketing professionals and people interested in business marketing. It's run by business marketers for business marketers, and we provide face-to-face and virtual event meetups, training, podcasts, blogs, newsletters, mentoring, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for business marketers. And today we've got over 1,000 participants across the world. If though this is the first time you've joined us, you're very welcome. Check us out at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. And if you've been with us before, well, welcome back. It's so good to have you along again. In this 100th episode, I'll be speaking about brand to the head of strategic customer marketing at O2, Mark Larwood, to marketing senior manager at Fiat Chrysler, Jason Fitzgerald, and to co-founder and head of growth of B2B International, Nick Haig. Today, we continue our A to Z of business marketing. We're looking to give a primer on the very latest thinking, practices, and practical examples on every big topic in business marketing land. And we've reached B, and B, unsurprisingly, stands for brand. We've got three experts talking on the topic today, starting with the head of strategic customer marketing at O2, Mark Larwood. Mark, welcome to the podcast, and over to you.
Thanks, Dave. Pleasure to be here. So I'm Mark Larwood, and I lead strategic customer marketing at Telefonica UK, or as Dave has mentioned, you guys will probably better know us as O2, and more specifically, in my case, O2 Business. I've been in B2B marketing my whole working life, straight from university 20-something years ago. And during that time, I've worked with some big companies and some well-known brands, you know, O2 being the latest, plus stints for Philips Electronics and Atos and other names that you'd have recognised. I've also worked in some really small businesses you've probably never heard of, Mblocks, Raining Data, Ixaris. And I think what separates these organizations, obviously, is scale, size, market presence. And I want to talk a little bit about the differences between small, large organizations when it comes to brand. So, you know, the big brands that I've worked for, I mentioned a few, have spent decades and huge sums of money cultivating their brand image. Clearly, brand is their reputation. And that brand is made from all those small and not so small, actually, experiences that individuals have when dealing with those companies, and importantly, the people within them too. You know, all that glossy marketing, brand messaging, iconography that we all push out, yeah, it means nothing if it's not authentic and if people can't relate to it and say, yeah, that aligns with my experience at Philips. You know, strong heritage brand, dependable technology, not cheap. Just an example of where I think, you know, it's really important that your brand promise is the same as what people really, really experience. And, whilst those smaller organizations that I've worked with as well don't have the clout, don't have the spend, don't have that brand awareness of a Philips or an O2 of this world, you know, brand is still incredibly important to each and every one of them. And I think in many respects, from my personal experience, I've almost felt closer to those brands, to those smaller brands, and felt that brand promise, brand essence, all of those good things were even more important in those smaller companies in some respects, or at least I felt that I had personally more leverage. You know, the things that I did, which my team did, which all those around me that I could see every day, those experiences that we drove for our customers and for our prospects and our other audiences, had so much more of an impact on the brand of those organizations than your efforts at big organizations can do, right? I felt I was living and breathing that every day. It's not that we're not in the larger organizations as well. It's feeling that, you know, there's that kind of stronger leverage and control over those sorts of things, I think. So I mentioned that brand perception is made up of small and large interactions that people have with business. And I'm sure all the listeners here, Dave, will appreciate, you know, brand isn't just the logo, color palette, set of messages, right? It's really everything you know, everything you feel about a business, and also ultimately whether you want to do business with that brand. So, yeah, growing up, you know, the jokes I heard were about Ladas and Skodas, right? They weren't about Mercedes and BMWs. Brand really does drive people's preferences. And if you allow me a slight digression, I remember having a discussion with my dad when he bought his first BMW. You know, I was adamant that he bought it for brand, you know, because it was a BMW. And he would swear blind then, and he would know as well that it's because it was the best car he test drove that day. You know, I still maintain it was the brand. You know, he'd said he'd buy a BMW since I was knee high to the proverbial grasshopper. You know, I think what we probably would both agree on is that if it wasn't the brand that he bought it for, the brand was the thing that got him to the showroom in the first place. So I kind of hear you thinking, how does that relate to B2B branding, Mark? Well, I really think the same principles apply in B2B. We all claim to make rational decisions when we're spending company money, but really there's a huge emotional process at play too. I think it was JP Morgan who said there are two reasons that people buy anything or do anything actually. You know, a good reason and the real reason, the rational and the emotional. And that really does apply to making purchasing decisions anywhere. It applies to B2B as well as consumer. So I think that good, strong brand work ensures we tap into both those drivers. You know, emotional plays to make people want to act, and then the rational to help them justify those decisions, whether as they're going through the process or afterwards, actually. Just one other great example, I think, of where a brand has tapped brilliantly into emotion was London 2012. Early on, Great Britain, UK, didn't have the strongest pitch. But what the London 2012 team realized is they didn't have to be everybody's favorite. In fact, after the first round, I think London was in third place. But what London had become was the first or the second choice of almost everyone. So how do they do that? By tapping into emotion. You know, it was not, you know, Paris has the best stadia in Europe, Madrid has the greatest culture. None of that for London 2012. 2012 was all about legacy and what the games would bring to generations long after the games had been and gone. It was that kind of lump to the throat type approach that really, really tapped into the emotional kind of, you know, next generation thinking of people. So personally, I've been through many rebranding exercises in the past. And I think they all start the same way. Bunch of people, very important, sat in a room, lots of introspection, followed by some field customer research around what customers think, you know, gap analysis or two processed later. And then we're on to defining our brand strategy, working up designs for new logos, agreeing messaging, et cetera. You know, all really important stuff, really critical to ensuring we build a good, solid brand. Now, I can only speak to my experience, really, but I think when those rebranding exercises have really worked well, it's when we've really looked into how that brand fits with the real life experiences of customers. You know, what happens when a customer calls you up, for example? Will their perception of your brand tally with what they experience? Will it align with your brand promise? And I think unless and until people see brand as omnipresent in every interaction with your business, then you really run that risk that your desired brand is not the real brand that is out there that people are experiencing in the market. I think it was Jeff Bezos reportedly said, you know, brand is what people say when you aren't in the room. So look, I'm no brand marketer. I'm not a brand master, but I do realize that all of us in marketing, and I have a, you know, a huge role to play in shaping and caring for the brand I work as, you know, as do all of my colleagues inside and outside of the marketing function. Brand for me isn't something that happens over there. You know, it's what we all do through everything else we're doing. Brand with a small B as well as with a large B. We can all make an impact. We all have a role as custodians of the brand and experiences that our customers have. I'm not a scholar of brand either. So, you know, this wasn't about sharing nuggets of advice or latest thinking necessarily. It was just my perspective on brand. A brand from someone who's been around a bit, worked for some big brands, worked for some smaller brands, and has an opinion. To close, I thought I'd just sort of talk about what I like in a brand, and hopefully that's been apparent through what I've said anyway. But, you know, I really like brands that deliver on a promise, you know, where you know what you'll get. You know, brands like McDonald's, Coca-Cola, even EasyJet, right? You know what you get. Brands that know what they stand for, that we know, that we stand for, and that we can trust and love. Thank you very much.
Mark Lawood, thanks very much. Our second brand expert is Senior Marketing Manager at Fiat Chrysler Automotive, Jason Fitzgerald. Jason, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave. Nice to be here.
It's good to see you. And over to you.
Yeah, so what I want to talk about, Dave, for a few minutes is brand loyalty. And in the B2B world, we encourage brand loyalty by looking after really important customers. This is what we think of as key account management, because we know key accounts are so important. They either usually drive volume or gross margin profitability. In doing this, we create loyalty where it is both to the brand, the product, the service, but also to the people involved who are serving their big customers and looking after their needs. Consumer marketing, B2C, hasn't really seen the world that way, because when you sell a whole load of consumer goods by the truckload, you can't look after every customer in the same way. You might look after the retailer, but you don't look after customers at an individual level. But I think they can still learn from each other in terms of how to look after customers and how to think about brands. I'll come back to that. Because what I want to talk about really when we're thinking about brand is brand loyalty. And I'm going to say something controversial, which is that brand loyalty is a myth. So people study it a lot, academics think about it a lot, but I simply think it doesn't really exist. And I have very personal reasons for saying this, and I've believed it for a long time. I had the misfortune once of saying these words amongst a group of marketing practitioners and marketing academics around a friendly dinner table, and regrettably the person opposite me at the table was an academic who had spent years of her life studying brand loyalty. So telling her that her area of expertise just didn't exist didn't go down too well. But my answer when she said, why do I believe that, at least made sense to her. And that's because I worked for 8 years of my life for a wonderful mobile phone company called Nokia. And those cool phones that people loved and that lots of people still of us have in the bottom drawer in the bureau, and it, you know what, it probably still works. According to market research in about 2005, 2006, Nokia had absolutely world-beating brand loyalty. Was one of the most valuable brands in the world every year, according to all the fancy valuations and calculations done by brand finance experts. It was up there above Samsung, way above Apple, actually, up there with Coca-Cola as the biggest brands in the world. So what happened next? Well, in 2007, a guy called Steve Jobs stood up on a stage and launched the iPhone. And it's not an exaggeration to say in a short period after that, Nokia smartphone sales fell off a cliff. So the question is, what happened to brand loyalty? Where did all those loyal customers go? They actually went to Apple in their droves, and whether that was enterprise B2B sales or B2C sales, it happened very quickly. So Nokia learned the hard way, and I learned the hard way, that brand loyalty doesn't really exist. You're actually only as good as your last product. And even then, your last product is compared to the best product of your rivals. So that's the story of Nokia. But of course, it's not really new, because the business world thrives on creative destruction. And innovation is required, because it's a game of survival of the fittest. The best companies do well, and the rest will go the way of the dodo. And right now, this trend is accelerating, because we're living through an era in the last few months where brand loyalty has been put even more to the test. We have seen, perhaps sadly for us marketers, there kind of never was such a thing. In mature markets during the lockdown, pressures caused by the pandemic and difficulty of doing our normal shopping has meant that actually people have switched to new providers, new online retailers incredibly quickly. The kind of change that we might have expected to happen over 10 years has happened in 12 months. In the B2B world, We have reports of European customers switching away from British suppliers because of problems caused at the borders due to new levels of border checks after Brexit. There's a report today in the BBC about January exports being down 40%, exports to Germany, actually. So the point is, when it comes down to it, for all the talk of brand loyalty, people change really quickly. The result is that finally, the academics are now starting to agree with me and say that what we had all along was a different thing. It was a kind of habit. People bought certain products as a habit. And actually, the research recently started to show that even within that habit, people shop within a basket of goods. So you might like Colgate, Crest, or Aquafresh toothpaste, but actually, if there's a discount on one of them, you'll switch quite quickly. Because all the brands sold well, statistically, it appears to look like loyalty. But at the level when you examine one customer's behavior, there's actually quite a lot of switching going on. This is actually relatively new news, and it's still sinking in for people in a lot of brand marketing. Back in 2020, Adweek's Lisa Lacey said that there is no such thing as brand loyalty beyond obsessed superfans. When we think about those superfans, we come back to thinking about a product like an Apple iPhone that has had queues around the block to buy the new product. And so we might say, does a super premium brand like an Apple or a Louis Vuitton heel or a Maserati supercar, does that have brand loyalty? And I think yes and no, but actually mostly no. Because for expensive products, now we're talking much more expensive than buying toothpaste, and even motor cars, there is less loyalty than previously thought. Google last year showed some research that proved that customers would switch quickly between different cars in their consideration set simply because one had a slightly better finance deal than the other. Now, if you talk to people who love their automotive brands at places like Maserati and Ferrari, they find that very hard to accept because people who are brand managers tend to be quite myopically in love with their own brands. But it speaks actually to a need to see things from the customer's point of view instead, which brings me back to where I started, because actually Nokia was incredibly good at seeing things from the customer's point of view and still has obviously struggled to keep up with customers' changing needs. Nokia, more than about 13 or 14 years ago, undertook one of the largest market research products ever done in business history. It was fantastic. It had 13 billion data points, all from major markets around the world. And what Nokia did was split the mobile phone market into 12 segments, ranging from what they called simplicity seekers, who just wanted an easy phone to use. Maybe they wanted larger buttons or larger font. And they were often older people or just people not willing to spend a lot of money on their phone. And that was the sort of lowest segment in terms of technology speed of adoption, all the way up to what they call technology leaders, who were the kind of people who I talked about earlier, who would queue up around the block to buy the latest iPhone or Samsung. After they researched this and found there are 12 different types of customers, the market research team did a great job of training thousands of marketing employees around the whole Nokia world about these customers and their needs. And the result was every Nokian knew quite a lot about these 12 different customer types. But the thing is, when it's everyone's job to look after every customer, there's a risk that it's no one's job to look after one customer. The research was useful, but in my opinion, it's quite a different thing from getting good at looking after your customers. To understand them is one thing. To look after them requires a kind of key account management like we see in the B2B world. Could Nokia have actually put individuals within marketing department in charge of each group of customers and looked after them like a key account. After the launch of iPhone, Nokia's share price was okay for a while. There was actually a feeling that the product would continue to sell to the people like I referenced as simplicity seekers and also to emerging markets. Even as an employee of the company, I wasn't convinced myself. In 2008, I was on the London Underground and going out towards Heathrow Airport. And there's a stretch of train track where you're underground and then you pop up somewhere in West London into the light. And light floods in through the windows. And not only do you get sunlight, but you get your mobile phone signal again, which you haven't had for a while. And there was a sort of a little old lady across the way from me on sitting on the tube, and she might have been a granny. And she would have been absolutely the type of person that Nokia would have said is a simplicity seeker. She likes a good, easy to use phone. That's her priority. So in late 2008, when this granny's phone beeped and she took an iPhone out of her handbag, I was kind of surprised. I thought this goes against everything that we've been told. And actually it shows that the market is moving much faster than we think it is. And looking after customers requires a kind of constant vigilance. In other words, it requires great key account management, not just a bit of market research that you do once and kind of hand over to people. So we know that Nokia's share price then start to tumble. We know that Nokia suffered and fell out of the top 10 brands in the world way down. And that story has been sort of well documented. But I think what we could all learn from that is that even the brands that are at the top of their game right now need to be constantly vigilant and thinking about looking after their best customers, their key accounts, in the best way they possibly can. And a couple of years ago, I was at Jaguar Land Rover, and they did some market research before launching the Jaguar I-PACE, which has been a very successful car for them, a very successful product, and the first premium electric car. Certainly the Germans, the BMWs, Mercedes and Audis didn't regard Tesla as a premium competitor. So Jaguar kind of looked at that and said, why isn't Tesla considered premium? Spoke to a bunch of Tesla customers. And I remember meeting a guy in Germany who said, I would love it if I could have the electric technology of a Tesla, but the product quality of an Audi, a Porsche, or maybe a Jaguar. And he gave us at Jaguar enormous confidence that we could break into this market, that Tesla didn't have a stranglehold on it. He talked about the fact that the little drops of rain came in through the window just because the seal was imperfect. And as a guy who'd been an Audi customer for a long time, he was used to the seal being perfect. So Jaguar said, we can make an electric car and we can go head on against Tesla. And you've seen that ever since. So Tesla is still right now king of the electric car. But my point is, they probably think they have brand loyalty, but the German manufacturers, the Jaguars of this world are all coming to get them. And even as a leader in electric cars, they need to be super vigilant. They need to look after their customers really well, like they are key accounts, because as I've discussed from the start, they might think they have brand loyalty, but there is no such thing as brand loyalty. Brand loyalty is simply a myth.
Jason Fitzgerald, Senior Marketing Manager at Fiat Chrysler Automotive. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very good. Thanks, Dave.
Our third brand expert is co-founder and head of growth at B2B International, Nick Haig. Nick, welcome to the podcast, and over to you.
Thanks, Dave. Well, I'm here to talk about brands today, and I think the importance of brand and brand building in B2B markets. I think brands are emotive things, even though sometimes in B2B markets we pretend emotion doesn't play a part. I mean, a good brand is remembered in the right way. A mediocre brand is very rarely remembered. But branding isn't just, as we all know, about logo. It embodies the personality of the business. It speaks volumes about who you are, who you're going, where you're going, and why people should love you. And I actually like the best definition I think of a brand is actually by Jeff Bezos, where he states that, you know, your brand is what other people say about you when you're not in the room. So branding is very close to my heart. I'm a researcher by heart. And so for today's conversation, I'll fall back on some survey data, really just to bring, you know, some of these truths home. But I think interestingly for today, over the last 2 years, we have our own survey that we send out there. We speak to various different CMOs and marketing directors globally. And back in the beginning of 2020, brand optimization was high on the agenda of CMOs and marketing directors. You know, optimizing the brand was number three priority behind understanding customer journeys and then measuring CX and customer loyalty. But that was pre-COVID. What we found is that most B2B organizations were failing to engage at an emotional level. We all know that the more engaged a customer is with a brand, the greater the emotional attachment there is to it, and emotions playing this major role in decision making, leading brands in market to be more successful at connecting with their customers. But what we've seen is, yes, brands, B2B brands, are very good at being trusted. You know, the brand needs to be trusted to enter the consideration set. So attribute examples like, you know, a brand that's got your back or a safe bet, you know, you can trust them to do what and give them peace of mind. But where they were still failing was at this emotional level. They definitely weren't engaging with empathy, and brands definitely weren't demonstrating an understanding of buyer or user needs and pain points. So there was lots of potential for brands to differentiate their offering in the marketplace. Then fast forward, you know, only a few months, and here we are in 2021. And post-COVID, what we found speaking to these same CMOs and marketing directors is that there's been a healthy rise in interest for demand generation or sales activation activity to convert leads, but raising top of funnel awareness and brand building has fallen to the bottom of the priority list. And it seems like people really haven't learned from past experience. There's data to show that in past recessions, you know, companies who keep investing in brand exposure experience deliver 30 to 40% incremental growth post-crisis. And I believe that's the big opportunity. Investing in your brand is a long-term strategy. You can't lose perspective by acting for the short-term interests, even during a pandemic, because you know, you're going to focus on today's podcast is going to explain a bit more around that. I think, you know, as Jeff Bezos said, you know, knowing what customers say about you when you're not in the room is even more important now in this digital age, as what we found out is many people's minds are already made up. 60% of the buying journey is made up before they even start talking to an individual salesperson at a company. So just if you're not managing that digital experience of your brand, just think of the importance or what you could be losing out. And I think, you know, we've looked at where and when B2B decision makers engage with suppliers as they go through the purchase journey. And if that 57% before they have direct interaction, this really is the opportunity for not only a strong brand, but align it with a great digital presence is super important. On that same survey that we carried out as well, just to hit home, our survey data showed that 95% of CMOs agree that feeling a connection to a B2B brand is just as important as feeling confident about what the company does. Mm. I mean, I know they are aligned there, a brand is a promise delivered, but nonetheless, you know, it shows the importance there. I mean, going back to basics, in terms of in a B2B sense, there's only three ways to make money. You can cut costs, you can sell more, or you can raise your prices. And I think Warren Buffett, the greatest investor of all time, says the single most important decision in evaluating a business is its pricing power. Good businesses can increase their prices, gain more customers. Bad businesses can't. And what drives pricing power? Well, it's marketing, and specifically brand marketing. Buyers are willing to pay premium prices for strong brands. That's why luxury marketers never run activation marketing, the buy now advertising. It really does cheapen a brand and weakens pricing power. And so brand building, it really has this positive effect, not only on short-term sales, because we as human beings are much more likely to buy from companies that we've heard of already, but by priming potential buyers with brand messaging, you find that your activation campaigns work much harder and therefore lowers activation costs and increases overall efficiency. So I think there's so many compelling cases that, you know, even though our research shows that people have started to look more at sales activation, brand building really is this opportunity. And I think, you know, through brand, you know, there's lots of opportunities through brand differentiation. You know, brands obviously cannot be copied. Pepsi cannot copy Coca-Cola in terms of the signature red color, scripted font, distinctive bottle shape even. Your brand really does code or distinctive assets that are ownable to you. And I think what we've seen through research as well is that brand is so important for other fallout things like, you know, the supplier brand. It really does benefit in terms of talent acquisition. So being able to focus on brand building and your brand is important. I think finally, in terms of just making sure that, you know, we all understand there's two different types of marketing and where brand building fits in. You know, at the top of the funnel, that's where brand building is all about. It's, you know, about awareness campaigns. And then obviously there's bottom of the funnel piece around activation, lead generation, gated thought leadership, sales enablement. But at the end of the day, it's all about communications, but they are two very different goals in mind. Brand building does mean about, you know, creating these mental structures, associations, memories, beliefs that will predispose potential customers to choose one brand over another. And it's a long-term job involving conditioning customers through these repeated exposures. So it does take time. On the other hand, you know, communications can be used for sales activation. And the aim here is very much to, you know, to get people to likely to buy in the very near future. And this means exploiting existing brand equity to generate the sales right now. But as I've mentioned, you know, that the first type of marketing is called demand gen or sales activation because it delivers short-term growth. It increases sales right away, but the results decay quickly. So all those people that we've seen in 2020 that, you know, really did flip their strategies and start to look at that bottom of the funnel piece, it won't last. And in fact, they've probably seen it drying up right now. But the second type of marketing activity, brand building, delivers long-term growth. It delivers some short-term lifts, of course, but the true value is all about over time, the influences it makes on future sales and future buyers. And in B2B, you know, we usually call, you know, the sales activation lead generation or demand generation, but that is an accurate description of how it works, because sales activation doesn't create demand. It just helps capture business tapped up demand that was already there. It already exists. And brand building is what actually generates demand in both the long term and the short term. Of course, businesses do need both, and they need brand activity to create demand. Getting that balance is right, each enhances the other. But because brand building is the bigger task, maybe that's the reason what we've seen in terms of, you know, it normally takes the lion's share of budget. And so when budgets get cut and times get tight, therefore budget's stolen from there to go towards other things. But the question most people ask us is, you know, what's the best marketing mix? Which levers to pull in terms of marketing activity? And we can look to our consumer cousins there to see, you know, there's lots of published data to see how efficient we should be around the marketing mix. And in fact, it's 60% of the communications budget is often devoted to brand in B2C, with 40% towards, you know, the sales activation side of things. But in B2B, what we see with certain data is that actually this does switch, and the maximized budget allocated to brand should be around and about, you know, up to and around 50%, between 45 and 50% with the other allocated to activation. It should be noted, of course, that that you know these mixes can change as companies grow. In fact, in the first year, some startups, you know, where you're looking to balance your budget, then it might be as much as, you know, 65% there on sales activation and only 35% for brand building. But actually, as you evolve and mature the brand, then that probably starts to move more towards, you know, probably 65% towards brand building, 35% towards sales activation. So I hope this podcast has helped to share with you the importance of brand. I'd like to leave you today with a quote from John Stewart, who was the former chairman of Quaker Oats Company. And I feel this typifies the importance of brands. If this business were to split up, he said, I would take the brands, the trademarks and goodwill, and you could have all the bricks and mortar, and I would fare better than you. I think what that really shows is that, you know, virtually every business is or contains a brand, and brands are powerful. Brands stand for something. Brands are valuable. Some contain, you know, some companies contain many. In fact, in B2B, world, sometimes too many brands, but that's definitely for another podcast or discussion. But brands are hugely valuable assets. And like any asset, you should take great care of it, because if you neglect your brand, and many B2B companies have in the past, then you do so at your own peril.
Nick Haig, thank you very much. And that's it. That's all for this 100th episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, to Mark Larwood, to Jason Fitzgerald, and to Nick Haig. And thanks to our technical team from Through the Eye of Scott Jackson, Andrew Gratian, Alex Horn, and Josh Bench. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. Do rate or review us if you can, and email me at davestevensnow@gmail.com if you'd like to be a speaker or offer feedback. There's 99 more episodes where this came from. Just go to businessmarketingclub.org.uk. But in the meantime, that's it for now. I hope to see you again. Thanks for listening.